Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Malcolm Turnbull is flying off to the United States, where he'll give an address to the United Nations General Assembly, as well as attending the President's Summit on Refugees. After New York, he'll go to Washington, where he'll meet with intelligence officials and also have talks on cybersecurity. Today, we're joined by Peter Jennings, Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, to discuss the Turnbull trip and other matters. Peter Jennings, how important do you think the Refugee Summit in New York is?
Well, hello, Michelle. I think the summit points to one of the most pressing international issues in the world today, which is 65 million people as refugees around the globe. Where it's hard to see much progress, though, is in what can be done about this situation. So I understand that the purpose of the meeting that Obama has called is to get other countries to accept more refugees through legal channels and to offer more aid assistance. On accepting refugees, I don't think he's going to make much headway because at the moment the Europeans are closing their doors rather than opening them. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see significant pledges of new aid, and Australia will probably be doing the same thing at that meeting.
Now, Malcolm Turnbull this week again reiterated a hard line on border protection. In fact, he went out of his way in Parliament to praise Tony Abbott for his stopping the boats policy. Do you think at this summit, and internationally more generally, Australia will be seen as a country that's closed in on itself in terms of this whole border issue, or will it be seen as a model for other countries who are now really worrying about influxes of asylum seekers?
I think in some ways people will look with a degree of jealousy on our strategic geography, because we are one of the very few countries around the world that does have the capacity to control our borders and to make it much harder for people to arrive illegally. There's no doubt that Australia generates some negative reactions internationally for what people see to be a hardline policy. I think that view is changing a little bit in Europe now because the Europeans are understanding just how difficult it is to manage this problem in an equitable way and keep control of borders at the same time. And I would expect that one of the things Turnbull should do is to make the point that we are accepting significantly higher numbers of refugees into Australia through legal channels, at the same time as many other European countries are actually reducing the number of refugee settlements. So I think the success of the Australian approach has been a mix of both hardline and open door approaches through legal channels. And sometimes that just gets pretty, it's a complex message to sell positively, and I think that's what the government has struggled with.
On the other hand, while we have increased the intake of refugees, the numbers are comparatively small, and with the Syrian intake that we made quite a lot of, the arrival rate is quite slow compared with, for example, Canada.
Yes, but to be honest, I think the Canadians went too fast and too quickly, and they may well regret in time that they didn't take appropriate security checking measures to make sure those people coming in were acceptable. Where Australia has been slow has been in that security checking area. And I understand that quite a few thousand of the 12,000 that were committed to have now been admitted. But this is difficult because we're talking about people that may not have papers or backgrounds that are easy to check. Again, you know, it's a case of balancing humanitarian interests with security ones. And I don't blame the government for being slow and deliberative in the way that it's gone about those security checks.
Now, his talks in Washington will take in cyber issues, and I think your institute is involved here.
Yes.
What will this cover?
Well, the Prime Minister, on his first visit to Washington as PM, announced that a new cyber dialogue would be established between Australia and the US to be run by my institute, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, and a counterpart think tank in Washington, D.C. And the idea is to bring together government officials and business people to talk about cybersecurity, because it's not just a government issue, it crosses into the private sector as well. And Mr. Turnbull will attend this meeting. There'll be a very senior US and Australian delegation going. And the idea is to see if we can find ways to more effectively link business into a discussion about cybersecurity, including on issues like counter-radicalisation, for example, where the internet has become one of the key methods for extremist jihadist groups to actually undertake recruitment. So there's a big agenda of issues that need to be discussed. And I think what the hope is that we'll see closer Australia-US cooperation emerging, not only in government, but also between business entities as well.
So from Australia's point of view, what is the major cyber threat? Is this countries? And what countries? Is it commercial spying, and by whom?
The cyber threat ranges from organised crime, which is probably what average individual citizens see in terms of scamming for money, and an alarmingly large amount of money is lost by people on what you might think is pretty unsophisticated cyber crime activities. But then at the other end of the scale, you've actually got states using cyber technology to undertake spying, and also to put themselves in a position where they may be able to damage critical infrastructure remotely by using computer code. This is an area that's new and something that we're all getting used to, but creates vulnerabilities across electricity, most of industry around the world. I think one of the biggest threats that we suffer now is becoming more and more publicly apparent, and that is what I would describe as Chinese state-sponsored cyber intelligence gathering, which is all usually around intellectual property theft. And it's as much focused on the business community as it is on Australian government, but it is everywhere. And it should be said, not just Australia, it's across the United States and Canada and Europe, a very widespread Chinese cyber intelligence gathering effort, which is only picking up pace over recent years.
So this obviously goes into a serious diplomatic issue. What can be done with the Chinese to try to get better behaviour?
Well, the last time President Xi Jinping visited Washington, D.C., which was in September last year, he actually made a public commitment with President Obama to reduce the amount of cyber intelligence activities against business in particular. I've heard American officials say that they have seen some drop off in Chinese spying, which has become less in the way of sort of blanket attempts to pick up intellectual property and much more targeted attempts at specific areas of industry and specific pieces of technology. So we've seen a small change in Chinese behaviour. I think more broadly the issue is to try to persuade China that it's actually got more interests in working as part of the economic system rather than simply predating off Western intellectual property. But there's a long way to go before China would actually seem to be getting to that particular view of the world. At the moment, it's more about how can they actually steal intellectual property and then use it in building their own military technology, or indeed their own non-military technology.
So really we need to strengthen firewalls until we can get a better attitude from China, if that's possible.
That's right. I mean, I think in Australia you can say there are two types of businesses or government entities. There's those who know they've been hacked by the Chinese and those who don't know that they've been hacked by the Chinese. And, you know, there's a large group of businesses and entities that frankly have not got appropriate cybersecurity measures in place. So there's an internal education exercise as well in order to make people understand that the first defence in cybersecurity is their own protection of their own online presence and their own protection of their computer systems, which
so
is simple but can be done.
Would an organisation like yours, which is essentially a think tank, would that worry about being hacked?
We worry very much about being hacked because, whilst the material we publish is freely available, there's also things like emails, contact books, contact databases. There's also connections into government entities, for example, which can be mined. If you arrive at a place like a think tank, you may actually be just looking to use that as an entry point to get into more sensitive computer systems. So at ASPE, yes, we work very hard to protect our computer security.
Well, just while we're talking about the Chinese, foreign donations has been obviously in the news recently, and now a parliamentary inquiry is going to look at that among a whole lot of other electoral issues. Do you think the question of foreign donations is something that is a threat to our democratic system, and in particular, do you think the Chinese use foreign donations as a form of soft power?
I think it's becoming increasingly obvious that Chinese-linked businesses are using foreign donations as a form of soft power, and we've seen on the public record, which is probably only the tip of the iceberg, that we are talking about millions of dollars going to all of the major political parties. And this is clearly not motivated by altruism. It's actually about seeking favours, trying to seek policy outcomes which are more beneficial to the perspective of the Chinese government in Beijing. And I think this is a concern. Now, Australia is one of very few countries which allows foreign donations. I think the state of our political parties is such that they're kind of losing their domestic support base in terms of active memberships in Australia. But it's really a dire situation if either of them then have to look at Chinese donations as being the thing that keeps them viable for election campaigns. So this has been
a
delicate...
Well, we look to Chinese investment and the Americans look to Chinese money.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think we just need to find ways to remove this temptation from our political parties. And I think this will come down to campaign donation reform. As a taxpayer, I'm happy to accept that we should probably be paying more for that if it means that these external influences aren't shaping what parties do. And I would hope that the parties would try and address this in a bipartisan way.
And ban those donations.
Yes, I think that's where we're going to go. And it should be said, this is relatively new in Australia, but throughout Southeast Asia and throughout the South Pacific, this has been a common form of Chinese influence buying over the years. And we've looked at, for example, the Chinese doing this with Solomon Islands politics and been rather superior in our attitude to say, well, that would never happen here. But the news is it is indeed happening in Australia.
It's a complex question, though, isn't it? Because some of these donations are given by people with dual citizenship.
That's right. And I think we've seen what might be described as attempts to sort of launder the donations in ways which make it look as though they've not come from overseas sources. I think the dual citizenship problem is a complicated one. But what I'd observe is there is no other country which seems to be engaging in this pattern and the volume of donations that China is. And surely we can be smart enough to find ways to sort of close these loopholes as they're discovered.
Going back to the Turnbull trip, he'll obviously be able to get a bit of a bird's eye view of the American presidential contest, although I don't think there are any plans at the moment for him to contact either candidate. But how do you see a Clinton victory or a Trump victory affecting the relationship with Australia and our regional politics in general?
I think either outcome really should force us to be thinking hard about how well-placed our alliance relationship is with the US now. Maybe for different reasons, though, Michelle. My sense is that a Hillary Clinton administration would be what I would describe as a somewhat more effective version of the Obama administration. Clinton was one of the original authors of the American rebalance to Asia, and I think that she will come to office with higher expectations of what Australia should deliver as a military ally of the United States, and I think she'll be more personally engaged in Asian security issues. So a Clinton administration means more expectations of Australia. And then in the case of Donald Trump, the first thing I'd say is I don't think we should be writing him off yet. He seems to be at least within striking distance of being able to win the presidency. And my view is that we need to be able to demonstrate to a Trump that we're not free riding on security in the way he thinks that Japan and some of the European allies are, that we have our alliance dues paid up, as it were. And that really comes down to saying to him, we're investing in our defence forces, we said we would, and we are credible alliance partners that aren't there just to benefit from American defence spending, but that we'll pull our own weight. And again, I think we should be testing whether that proposition's really true and if the Trump administration would believe us if we said that to them.
Do you think a Clinton administration would in fact want Australia to play a bigger role in the fight against Islamic State?
I think they will, because I would expect a Clinton administration to be more actively engaged in that fight than the Obama administration is. I would imagine, for example, that Hillary would be prepared to use a smaller number of American troops in the Middle East. I'm talking about maybe a few thousand more, something up to 10,000. And I think if the US does that, they will certainly turn to their closest allies to say, now, what are you going to do?
Recently, Australia has widened the rules of engagement for the Australian forces in that fight. How do you think that the overall conflict is going? Is any progress being made?
Yes, we are making progress. It's been a very slow, rather arduous affair in terms of reducing the number of Islamic State fighters in Iraq in particular, and closing that border between Turkey and Syria, which is where the foreign fighters were coming in to join IS. I think that we should have been attempting to deliver a killer blow against IS in Iraq much sooner and faster than we have.
How do you do that?
Oh, it would have been through actually expanding the capacity for airstrikes much earlier than we did, with precisely what Malcolm Turnbull announced a week or so ago. In other words, we could, instead of a campaign which was almost literally about killing individual IS soldiers when they could be identified, we would have gone after larger numbers of IS people, not necessarily immediately engaged in combat. You know, the price of doing this slowly is that we've allowed a terrorism campaign to now be added to what the IS is doing in Europe and elsewhere. So we've actually invited some of this problem more closely into our shores. But I think that Turnbull's decision to widen those rules of engagement is the right way to go and will be well welcomed by the other partners in the air campaign.
Seems to me one could argue that Turnbull's language has morphed into much of the Abbott language in recent times. Turnbull earlier used the question of terrorism to differentiate himself, I think, from Prime Minister Abbott, but yes, there has been a subtle change in as he's had to take the decisions.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's a bit like the journey that Julia Gillard went on. I think all Australian Prime Ministers, particularly those who start with not a big interest in national security, find that they've got no choice other than to cultivate that interest and actually begin to make more use of those instruments of power they've got available to them. And I think in Malcolm Turnbull's case, it's also been a realisation that the domestic terrorism threat is not going away. It's kind of there at a lowish level under the surface, but it continues to present a serious problem. And so he's learning from the experience and concluding that he's got to get tougher, which I think is what's appropriate to actually deal with the threat.
Looking at his foreign policy over the past year, how different is it from the Abbott foreign policy?
It's a really hard question to answer, actually, Michelle. I mean, the first point to make is that neither Abbott nor Turnbull really set out to sharply articulate what their foreign policy priorities are. And I'm very pleased that Julie Bishop has announced that Foreign Affairs is now going to be producing a white paper to kind of set out the bigger picture priorities for this government. But, you know, so far I think what we've seen from Malcolm Turnbull has been more reacting to events, which of course is a large part of what foreign policy does. And we've yet to have that articulation of what are the sort of key factors driving government priorities.
Kevin Rudd was always anxious to have Australia play a very active role as a middle power. Do you think that since that time we have retreated from activism or continued it?
I think there's been less appetite since Rudd to produce sort of detailed plans and strategies. I mean, Rudd was very much the sort of the ultimate policy wonk when it came to delivering these things. I mean, for example, Rudd produced the 50-point plan for growing the closer Australia-Germany relationship. It just happened, nothing was ever done.
I think I missed that one.
Yeah, well, and there were many others besides. I think what we've had since then from all three prime ministers has been a much more pragmatic approach. And, you know, what we need is a balance here. We don't want to sort of over-plan, over-specify, because you have to be able to react to events as they emerge. But you also need some guiding foundations, and that's what I hope a new foreign affairs white paper will produce.
Do you think that there are signs that Turnbull would like to become more of an activist, or basically is his attention on the domestic scene and foreign policy is sort of an add-on?
I think he had a good week politically in the last week, where he had his international G20 and then the Asian summit and the Pacific Islands Forum, where it was actually a very good thing that an Australian Prime Minister was prepared to go to that. So in a sense, it may well be that he's discovering, again, as quite a few Prime Ministers do, that the international stage is a good environment. And Australia has always been a serious and credible player that tries to do good things internationally. So I think what we'll see from here on is a Malcolm Turnbull that wants to become more involved internationally and is now thinking about this that role, not simply in terms of trade and business, but also the national security dimensions.
It's interesting that he's invited regional leaders to Australia for a summit in 2018. Mm. Is this a good idea?
Yes, I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, I wish we were in a position to have those ASEAN countries here in 2017, but that's their 50th anniversary and they're probably maxed out in terms of the various events that they'll be running. But the idea of a deeper Australian engagement with the Southeast Asian countries is clearly a strategic driver for us. And I think it's a great initiative that the PM's decided to do that.
Just finally, we've had Pauline Hanson this week deliver her second maiden speech, in which she has said that Muslims are swamping the country. Do you think that the views that she's articulating, and more importantly, the publicity that she is getting in Australia, is in danger of giving us a bad name yet again internationally, as she did 20 years ago?
It certainly doesn't help. I mean, my concern about Pauline Hanson is that she gives conservatism a bad name. She sort of overlooks what I think are more credible reasons, for example, to be concerned about foreign investment into critical infrastructure, or overlooks reasons to be, you know, more concerned about the basis of Islamist extremism, and turns it instead into a rather ugly populist debate, which doesn't help Australia. I guess the other point I'd make, though, is that in a sense, Hanson is a sort of a canary in the mineshaft, perhaps pointing to anxieties in the wider Australian population, which aren't addressed by the standard debates and the standard talking points that we hear from our politicians. So my view would be, I would hope that, you know, that we don't get a sort of overwhelming media focus on what she's saying, but that somehow governments and oppositions need to intelligently address these things so as to keep the population with them and not to allow this type of populist anger from getting too much public support.
That's going to be a pretty big challenge. Peter Jennings, thanks very much for talking with The Conversation today. And that's all from our podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.